Usually when we are in spaces like this, people can have a range of different experiences. People can have the sense of like, oh my gosh, we're moving too fast. I can't write things down fast enough. Anybody have that experience? Great. Well, I gotta ask a different question. So sometimes it feels like we're moving really, really quickly. And some of that is because we're trying to cover a lot of material. Some of it is because of the nature of the material we're trying to cover. Just so you know this, the most beautiful and the most durable things that are created in the world, take a long time to make. The most beautiful and durable things take a really long time to make. And if what we are doing are forming souls, right? If that's the business that we're in, if we're in the business of creating communities of goodness and beauty, if you are here not just to learn something about how to feel better about yourself, but you're really here because, and even today, God is doing something in the room, right? Because that's one of the more important questions that we have to be asking ourselves throughout our time, today and tomorrow. What is God doing right now in the room, in my mind, in my heart, in my life? That is practice that takes perseverance. That is practice but remember, for example, many of us in the course of what we've heard so far, it's entirely possible, probable, that elements of your own stories have been raised to your awareness. Parts about your own life, parts of your own unfinished business, is becoming much more aware to you, maybe even more aware than you'd like it to be. And of course, part of what's difficult about this is that we're in a room full of people in which these things are coming into my head, but I'm by myself even though I'm sitting at my table, they're coming in my head by myself. And I don't have somebody else to turn to and say, right now, can we just stop? Kirk, you just stop? Because I need to start talking about my story right now. I want to suggest something to you. I want to suggest that sense of urgency, this awakened awareness of your story, I want to invite you to consider, that's the work of the Holy Spirit. This is the work of God bringing things to your awareness that you perhaps knew but didn't know, if you know what I mean. We've talked so far about the mechanics of the mind. That's how I like to say it. We've talked a lot about the mechanics of the mind. We've given us a working description of it. We've given us a way to think about the different domains of the mind. We've recognized that these domains, in order for them to work well, they need to work well together. And if the domains of my own mind are going to work well together, in order for that to happen, I need to be in community with other people. If I'm going to develop a community of goodness and beauty, whether I'm working as an architect or as a construction worker or as a lawyer or as a teacher or as a scuba dive instructor, whatever it is that I'm doing, I'm going to do so more effectively as I am able to bring these various disparate parts together, because they are being exercised to become more well practiced and then linked together. Those are the mechanics. But there's something else that's important for us to be aware of. These mechanics are all taking place in a context. Remember, we said earlier that there's this thing called a plausibility structure. There's a way in which we tell stories. And we could talk about all this stuff till the cows come home. But the real question is, into what story do these mechanics actually take place? Like, what's the story that you think you're living in? We've said this from the beginning. In what story do I believe I'm living? And I want to suggest to us that if you read the biblical narrative isn't just going to talk about the mechanics of the mind. It's going to tell us how we are to live. And one of the things that the biblical narrative suggests, and I'm going to suggest, is that we were created to live in the presence of joy. That you were made for joy, right? I'm talking now, if someone were to walk in here with a newborn and you all noticed it, I would disappear from your consciousness, right? Because the newborn is going to suddenly take center stage, because we know that when we see a newborn, we just can't stop looking at this baby, right? And when we look at the baby, what do we want the baby to do? We want the baby to smile. And then when the baby smiles, we think like, look how much power I have to make the baby smile. And in fact, you do. This is what's happening, right? You're turning things on in that baby's brain that if you don't do that with the baby, aren't going to happen. And so you turn this thing on the baby and the baby smiles and then you smile. And the baby smiles at you smiling and it's a party, right? And we would suggest, as Tolstoy did a long time ago, the human beings were created for joy. Now, a few years before that, there was a thing called the Westminster Confession. Anybody here familiar with the Westminster Confession? Right. What's the chief end of man? Glorify God and enjoy Him forever. Enjoy Him. But I want to suggest something. And I'm sure that the Westminster cats were really smart, right? When they wrote this. I don't have any doubt about that. But I have a question for us. When we hear that, when we hear that we were created to love God, to obey God, to glorify God, and to enjoy Him forever, what does that mean, to enjoy God? Right? This is one of these things where we say, oh yeah, the Westminster, I know what that is. Like I tell you, and like I have no idea what that means. Right? Like, what does it mean for us to enjoy God? I can't see Him. I can't touch Him. How am I supposed to enjoy God? Now, let me ask you this. For those of you who have children, if you have children, as parents, do you want your children to enjoy you? Thank you. That's the right answer. Okay. I'm thinking like with all, like I stand later to make a lot of money off of you people because like some of these questions are being answered in really disturbing ways. I mean, it's simple. It's straightforward. Do you enjoy your kids? Yes, we do. Right. Yeah. But what is it about you that you most want your children to enjoy? Have we thought about that? I'm going to suggest something to us. I mean, there might be lots of answers, and there's not like one single right answer or wrong answers to this, but I want to suggest something to you. I want to suggest that the thing that we were made to enjoy most about God is God's enjoyment of us. How many of us, if we are parents, and we give our child a gift, a toy. Our child is 8 years old. Do we want our child to spend most of their time coming back to us and telling us what wonderful parents we are for having given them this gift? No, largely what I want my child to enjoy the gift. And I want my child to see me enjoying them. And that's what it does. Like our kid enjoys us seeing them enjoy the thing that we've given to them. They enjoy our delight in them. Does that make sense? Developmentally, this is what children do all the time. Newborns become infants, which become toddlers, and toddlers toddle. But before they toddle, sometimes they crawl. And when they crawl or they toddle, they go away, and then what? They go away for a few feet, and then what do? They turn around and what? Look at you. And what do they want to look for? They want to look for your delight with their walking away. And then, like, they go off to college. There's always this sense that they take delight in our delighting in them. And I want to suggest this is why you were born. Lewis, in his magisterial Weight of Glory sermon, if you haven't read it lately, read it tonight, talks about this notion of how there's nothing that any creature, a dog, maybe not cats, because we don't really understand cats, but dogs. There's nothing that any creature enjoys more than its master enjoying them. Are you with me? Children delight in our delighting in them. But we somehow have concocted this idea that God is this being who's rather, as it turns out, pretty insecure. And God needs us to enjoy him, because if we don't, he'll be lonely. He'll be upset. There'll be some, and we're in trouble if we don't enjoy him for his own terms. Are you with me? I want to suggest to us that we were created in joy for joy. And this is a really big deal, because evil despises this. Tolstoy said it. The Westminster Confession has written it. But not only that, what do you get when we read Genesis chapter 1? And in the beginning, this is the NRSV, in the beginning, when God was creating the heavens and the earth was void and formless, and a great wind from God swept over the deep. You get that picture? Formless and void. How many of us are here in this room with anywhere from our entire life to significant parts of our life to small crevasses in our life that feel formless and void? And the wind of God is sweeping. And when it does, it says, "Let there be light." And there was light, and evening and the morning and the first day. And God said, it was good. And we read that, Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, verse 2, verse 3, verse 4. It was good, it was good, it was good. And he made the light, and he made the waters. And he separated the light from the darkness, and he separated the waters, and it was good. And then he made the Ohio State Buckeyes, and it was very good. Thanks be to God. And, and we read these texts rather linearly, because that's what it feels like how they're written, right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I want to suggest something to us. I want to suggest that at the end of every day, God actually has a party. It was good, let's have a party. It was good, let's have another party. 6 parties in 6 days. Because God was overwhelmed with the joy of it was good. This is not just a common statement about an abstract precept. This was, my goodness, look at this. It was good. And like, and you're wondering, like, my goodness, like, how do we go from from wind sweeping over chaos and void and formlessness? How in the world is good coming out of this void, formless, marriage, this void formless job, this void formless church, this void formless you name it. I want to suggest to you that even in those spaces where we can't see it, God's vision for your most formless void life is joy. But it's really hard for us to imagine this by ourselves because we were never meant to, not ever. And so we have all of this progression in Genesis 1 that really points to this notion that we were created for joy. But not just an ancient text. As it turns out, the work of Alan Shore, he's a neuropsychologist at UCLA, the work of Alan Shore suggests that the primary mission of any newborn to 18-month-old child, their primary mission is the development of joyfully attached human relationships. That's their primary job. They are looking for every opportunity that they can to connect joyfully with someone else. Every child is looking for someone, looking for her or for him, and it never stops. And I will tell you, we're still doing that here today. We come into this room, and we, without even being aware of it, we are hoping that someone will joyfully be coming to find us. But as was asked earlier, like, well, what happens when someone actually does? What if what they actually find is not very attractive? I think I'll keep my distance, thank you very much. I think I would like to be known up to a certain point, but no more, thank you very much. Because I am happy for you to, like, assume a joyful posture toward me, as long as we're talking about the parts of me that I'm okay with you knowing. I was talking earlier with a couple of gentlemen about businesses, about like, what do we do? What if you're a leader? And you have vulnerabilities. What if you have to reveal that you don't have the answer to the question? You're the CEO of the business and you don't have the next new strategy. But of course, that's what you're paid to do, right? Isn't that true? You're the pastor. You're paid to have the answers for the questions. But you don't. Because, like, who can have all the answers to all the questions? But of course, you don't want to reveal this to anyone, especially to your elder board, because they're the ones who expect you to do this, and they actually also pay your check. It is in that moment when we are actually ripe for the most explosive creative growth that we could ever imagine. But we can't, because evil will not allow it. But what would it be like for us to say to those whom we are most afraid of, this is the part of me that I want you to know in order for us to co-create something together that otherwise will not ever be imagined? Shore would suggest that this developmental mission of looking for joyfully attached human relationships is something that never stops. So I have a question for you. We're going to keep coming back to some version of this question throughout the rest of our days together. Who are the people that are coming to find you and that you're looking for, who, when they see you, are saying to you, my goodness, am I glad to see that you're here. I am so glad that you're here. I'm so glad that you're here. Come sit with me. Come sit with me. Jim Wilder and his group are really good at this. If you know Jim Wilder's work, they've got a book called Joy Starts Here, a whole program around this. Some of you may be familiar with this. And this notion of imagining what it's like to be joyfully pursued by the people who are in your life. What is it like for us to do that? Well, I would go further and ask this question. Did you see them this morning, in your bedroom? You're wondering, did I see who in my bedroom? I saw my wife in my bedroom. I didn't see any, like, I didn't see any, not plural, I didn't see anyone else. Let me ask you a question. What if at the end of this day, let me ask this question. How many of you here are here and your best friend is here? Like, you raise your hand like, yeah, my best friend is here in the room. Yeah, so there are a number of you here. Your best friend is here. Let me ask you this. What if you go home at the end of the day, you go into your house or your condominium, you walk into your kitchen, and there are your three best friends. Not your best friend, not just your best friend. Your three best friends are there. They're not sitting in the dark. The lights are on. They're not jumping out to say, boo. I'm there to do that. They're like, and you're like, now, okay, once you get past it, like, okay, who died kind of thing. Like, once you get past this, because it would be weird, right? Like, because who does this? But imagine, you're three best friends, and you walk in, and you're like, what are you doing here? And they're like, you know, we all three called each other this past week, and we thought, like, we just have to go be where Sarah is. We just have to go be where Greg is. We just really want to be where he is. This would be weird, right? This would be totally weird. Like, we don't do this. I want to suggest this to you. When I ask, did you see them? Do you know that the Holy Trinity was in your bedroom when you woke up? Waiting for you. Right? You wake up and, oh my gosh, there he is sitting on the chair. And you wake up like, who are you and what are you doing? He's like, we have been waiting for you all night. It's going to be, you're going to go hear this shrink. It's going to be awesome. We can't believe that we get to live this day with you. His eagerness, God's eagerness for us to see his delight in our presence is what he longs for us to see. We were made and invited to live into the dance of the Holy Trinity. And this is what all of our brain science is telling us. But how many of us wake up in the morning and the first thought is something very different? The first thought is a very different story that we're telling. You see, the biblical narrative tells a story in which we were made in joy, for joy, and that hasn't stopped. The problem is we've stopped paying attention to it. This is not, folks, just a theological concept. This is about practicing things, right? Neuroplasticity, changing our brains. We become what we pay attention to. We become what we practice. If this is what we were made to do, this then eventually merges into and emerges into what we as human beings then eventually do in ways that no other animal does. As we've already hinted at and said a little more directly, we tell stories. And we've been storytellers from the time before we were born, as it turns out. We tell stories. We said earlier, our friend Steve, whose son hanged himself. Steve's was a hard story. But no harder than my friend John. John grew up in a state. It's in the north of the country. It has many lakes. I won't name it. There are many states that have many lakes. This one has many thousands of lakes. And near one of these lakes, John grew up on a farm. And John was the third of five children. But John also grew up with a father who was mean. And one day when John was eight, John was getting ready for school, and as he did so, he was in a rush. And he washed his hands at the sink in the bathroom and was about to leave, and his father said, "Did you wash your hands and your face for school?" John said, "Yes." He said, and his dad said, "Did you wash with hot water?" At which point, John knew that if he answered truthfully, that he was going to be in big trouble, the nature of which he knew not. So he did the next safest thing, and he said, "Yes, I washed with hot water." And his father said, "Let's go see how hot the water was." Takes John back up to the bathroom, only to find out that it's cold water. At which point, John's father took 8-year-old John in January outside to the creek, icing over, made John take his shoes and his socks off. And made John stand in the creek and said, "Now I think you'll know what the difference between cold and hot is. You can't make this stuff up." Joy was not John's story. And I dare say that there are people who are in this room who know what John's story is like. And so John's telling of his story, interestingly enough, includes a capacity to tell me the details of this story like he was reading a stock market report. And when I asked John, "As you tell me this, what do you feel?" He said, "I don't really feel anything." I would dare say you in this room feel far more in hearing this story than John did as he told it to me. Notice, depending upon the environment in which we grow up, depending upon our attachment patterns, depending upon the way we are more or less integrated in our families of origin, we end up telling our stories in particular ways that are either more or less integrated, that are more or less whole, that are more or less joyful, as it were. And I will tell you that if that's the story I'm telling, and then you come and tell me that Jesus loves me, it doesn't really make a lot of sense to my brain. Are you with me? You know, Nancy Reagan, God rest her soul, some time ago was part of an effort to help prevent drug abuse. You may remember this. There was a campaign for a while, right? And it went like what? Just say no to drugs. All well and good, right? Well intended. It's fine. There's only one problem. And that is that the part of the brain that hears "just say no to the drugs" has got nothing to do with the part of the brain that does the drugs. Right? It's really difficult to tell my story effectively in such a way by trying to get my left brain to shoehorn things into my right brain that it's not really ready to take on. And so even when we in this room have elements of our story that are bubbling to the surface throughout the course of this day and tomorrow, we would like for someone to just say something that will solve this. Did we say that following Jesus is hard to do? This is part of why it is. We're going to hear a lot tomorrow about what Jesus did, what he modeled, and what he's calling us to do, to undo, to heal, and then to commission us out of places of shame into places of vocational liberation. But I will tell you, it will not be done simply by uttering a certain set of words, because my left brain isn't able to do that all by itself. It can't just utter things from my left to my right side and make it be true. It's hard to do that. How do we tell stories? Well, the first thing to know about telling stories is that we didn't begin our story. You know Billy Joel, "We Didn't Start the Fire"? You know that song? So, you know Billy Joel? Mm-hmm. I'm just checking. Okay. It's true. We didn't start the fire. Somebody else started to tell your story long before you ever arrived. So my story can be told in more than one way. One of the ways that we can tell my story is that I am the youngest of four sons, which is true. My parents, I was born and raised in Ohio, and my parents were 45 when I was born. Now in 1962, I heard those voices. In 1962, and I think in 1962, it was pretty uncommon for people to be having babies at age 45, right? Because Betty and Lewis Thompson, right? Because people are wondering, like Betty, Lewis, like, what were you doing? Okay, we know what you were doing. But part of the challenge is that if you're 45 in 1942, people are really worried about all kinds of things, right? About how this kid's gonna turn out. And in my case, they're still worried. It's still a worry. But what this meant was that my story began being told anxiously. I mean, my parents, they're both deceased. Lovely, lovely, God-fearing people. Love them. But they didn't want me. Okay? Now, we're not throwing them under the bus. I don't mean that they didn't want me like, you know, they didn't want me. But you know what I mean? Like, if you'd have asked Betty, like, 6 weeks into her pregnancy, "Are you really thrilled?" And she would say, "Get out of my house." Right? She's not thrilled. My father's not thrilled. Hey, we've had our sons. We thought we were done. My brothers were 18, 16, and 11 when I was born. Okay? So one way that we can tell my story is that I'm the youngest of four sons. I'm the fourth of four sons. But that's not the only way that you could tell my story, right? Because by the time I was five, all of my brothers were out of the house, married with kids. By the time I was five, one could say, "Oh, you're the firstborn of a second family," right? Your parents had one family, and now they're going to have another family, and you're it, right? Which means you're not only the firstborn, you're the only born, which has its pros and cons as well. But not without remembering that long before you ever arrived, somebody else was telling your story, and you were an anxiety provocateur. Now, nobody likes to tell people, "Gosh, you make me anxious." Well, at least we're not honest about it, right? I mean, people make us anxious, right? But we would never say this to them. You know, it's true. But this is like, how many of us, right? How many of us in this room can think about, "Oh my goodness, like my story began, somebody else is telling my story." And for some of us, we were wanted. For others, we were not wanted. I mean, there's a whole range, an array of ways in which our story was being told long before we were born. I wonder how much of that story you know. And by that, I don't just mean, do you know the facts about your story? I mean, do you know what it felt like for your parents to literally be expecting you, anticipating you? Our stories always begin by being told by someone else. The second thing that we see about storytelling is that as we move forward in the storytelling process, it gradually changes to a point in which I have more and more and more of a voice in telling my story, but I never get to a point where I tell my story alone. Stories are always and forever told collaboratively. The Bible is one story told by a bunch of different authors. You come into the world, and people are still telling your story. How do they do it? They put clothes on you that you wouldn't be caught dead in today. You're going to wear this. You're going, and you know, and they're making your best friends for you, right? They're taking you to play dates with people who, like, when you're 14, you couldn't stand. But like, when I'm 2, I'm gonna go play with Jeremy, right? Because this is what my mom wants to do. And they're toting us around, like they're telling our story. But there are other ways, as we will see tomorrow, when we talk about all kinds of ways in which shame shows up, right? Shame shows up so early in our life that we don't even have to be, we don't even have to have acquired language for it to be able to like have an effect on us, right? So if we're in, if we are small and we are in a house in which our parents are arguing with one another, like they are telling our story. They're not talking to us about us, but they are telling us the story that I live in a life in which this house feels like it's upsetting to be here. Are you with me? The storytelling is always done collaboratively, and it never changes. Here's a question. Who are the voices that currently now reside in your head that are most prominently helping you tell your story? Is it your dad? Is it your mom? Is it your best friend? If it's God's voice, what does it sound like? If it's Jesus' voice, what does it sound like? What does he look like? This storytelling is a big deal. And we are telling it all the time, and we are always telling it collaboratively. Always, that whole thing, it's not good for man to be alone. In fact, I'm gonna make it such that nobody can tell their story at all without the help of somebody else. And this is both like good and not so good. Because John's story was being told rather brutally as well, right? Can you imagine what an 8-year-old is supposed to do to make sense of being forced to stand in a frozen creek? Like, how do you make sense of this? There's no making sense of this, but one has to find a way to survive this. And so we make up stories. This is what we are doing all the time, right? We've all grown up in families in which certain things have taken place for us that are hard for us to know. And we have just decided, well, we're gonna find a way to make sense of this. How do we do that? Stories are also told largely, I like to say, stories are told largely without language. Imagine going to see a movie. Now, how many of, what was it? It won Best Picture several years ago, but it was a silent film. Piano Player. Piano Player, right? Great film, silent film. But imagine the opposite. Imagine you go to see the film and all you hear is dialogue. There's nothing on the screen. That's kind of a bummer, right? That's not the kind of movie I want to go see. The point is that when we go to the movies to see the story, most of what makes up the story is not the dialogue. Most of what makes up the story that we are telling, all that nonverbal communication, is not about language. Evil depends upon this. How many of us have been involved in conversations? I won't say with whom. You might be married to them. You might have given birth to them. In which 3 days later, we're having a conversation about the conversation that we had 3 days ago. And someone says something like, well, when you said, Dava, and you said, I didn't say that. Oh, yes, you did. I did not say that. Right, this happened, right? It was like, well, then what did you say? Well, no, you know how this goes. Our memory puts things into motion in which now we're going to tell this story very differently 3 days later. And what happens if I'm a person who grew up much like our pediatric cardiothoracic surgeon who's paying a lot of attention to logical linear processes, right? Because he needs to know that he knows that he knows. And as he does so, he knows exactly what you said, how you said it, when you said it. He can measure it because he's got a steel trap mind. He knows that his two-year-old is smart. And he knows that when he says to his two-year-old, please come over here, that the two-year-old is smart enough to understand this. And that when the two-year-old doesn't come, it's because the two-year-old is simply disobedient. As opposed to, the two-year-old's brain is exploding and the two-year-old's just like kind of off being whatever the two-year-old's being. But because I, who live mostly in my left brain, am not aware that there's more to my two-year-old than just language, I don't know that more is going on here than just simple disobedience. And so what do? I yell at my two-year-old without being willing to do the extra work of attuning to my two-year-old before I come to do the work. And so my two-year-old ends up experiencing a story in which I, the father, am collaborating with, telling him that he's disobedient when he doesn't even understand what that word means. How many of us have had, not just in families, but in business and work, right? In school, professors, coaches, in which the collaborative storytelling methodology of choice surely involves words, but is not mostly language. So I was 7 years old. Now you have to know that in my house growing up, my father died. So here's some of my story. My father died when I was 17. After several years of heart failure, he had several heart attacks, and he had died of congestive heart failure. And I have these three older brothers, and I lost one of those brothers 12 years ago to pancreatic cancer. And I lost another brother two and a half years ago to prostate cancer. And my oldest brother remains. And I hate cancer. Just hate it. But on this day, when I was 7, my three older brothers decided that they wanted to get me a puppy for Christmas. Now, you have to know my dad. My dad, who grew up on a farm and was an animal lover, deep respecter of animals, but animals, in his mind, needed to stay outside, right? Animals we love, cows. Cows live outside, right? Hogs live outside in most people's houses, right? So if you want to have a dog, it's fine, but you have to have it outside. And he didn't think that we had enough property. We'd be living where we were living in our little town. He didn't think we had enough property to have a dog outside, and we were not going to have any inside pets because that's not where animals belonged. But my brothers had other ideas. And they were really, really quite bent on getting me a puppy for Christmas. And so, I mean, and I knew, like, we all kind of know that, like, you know, no, you don't have animals in the house, the Thompson house. Like, I don't even think about this. So my brothers colluded with my mom. And they apparently, I hear this story later, right? Because they said to my mom, look, we want to get Kurt a puppy. And she said, you get the puppy, I'll take care of your dad. I'm not really quite sure what she meant by that, but I'll just let you consider whatever you want to consider. You can collaboratively tell this story with me. I don't have any explicit memory of that Christmas morning. What I do have is an 8mm film of me at age 7 coming into the family room, lifting a box off the ground, and out jumps this puppy. We're watching this on the film. And I am out of my mind with delirium. I'm jumping up and down. I don't know what to do. The puppy's like running all over the place, right? I don't even know. Like, I just cannot believe what has, like, it's the second coming, right? It's that big. And And by 3 o'clock that afternoon, the dog was gone. I have one person who's laughing, right? Everybody, okay, now think about this, okay, right? Now what did you just feel? A range of different things, except for our gentleman over here in blue, right? He's a bit of a sadist. This was a story that for me has most frequently been told by my brothers because I didn't have much of an explicit memory of it. I do have the vague memory of on that morning and then later that afternoon when it was somehow through trickle-down communication, it was made clear to me that the dog was gone. I had the vague sense that I'm going to have to be okay with this. No one, I have no memory of anybody ever coming to me and saying, we can't keep the dog, which is kind of strange. Now, I'm not telling you that nobody did say those things to me. I simply have no memory of it. Now, here's the other odd thing. I, for the longest time, have told this story dozens of times. I've told this story. And mostly what I'm doing is I'm telling a story that other people have told me because I don't have an explicit memory of it. And when I tell it from the vantage point of which it has been told to me. And when my brothers have told this story over the course of years, it's all been kind of funny, especially my middle brother who bought the dog because he likes to remind everybody that his other two brothers never paid him back for the dog that he had to buy. And so frequently when I tell this story, I tell it, and people are kind of like, oh, and some people laugh. It's just kind of a funny story. Here's what happened. Back in November, I was with our staff from our practice, and we had a staff retreat. And people were just telling stories about things, and people were starting to tell dog stories. And I said, hey, I got a dog story. And I tell this story. And I'm telling the story, I'm like, yeah, by that afternoon, the dog was gone. And my colleagues, they were aghast. And I'm like, looking at them, and I'm like, what's wrong with you people? Like, it's a dog. At which point they say, like, no, dude, it was a 7-year-old boy. And I'm like, look, this is a first world problem. Like, this is not something for me to be complaining about. Like, this is not that tragic of a story. To which they would say, oh, really? You, the psychiatrist? And I'm like, who hired you? Right, like, why is it so hard for you to accept that, like, no 7-year-old should be treated like this? Like, we get it, we get it. Like, they would say, like, yeah, we know, it's not cancer. Like, what's taking your brothers? It's something else that was taken. And it wasn't just the puppy, right? So as it turns out, I've grown up telling a story largely that didn't use words. And the story that I've told for 54 years is that in many respects, what I feel, what I want, what I desire, just doesn't matter. And so you practice learning that a lot of what you want is not to be said because you do so upon pain of, like, upsetting people. My father, a God-fearer, was not an angry person. But part of how it is that we probably knew that is because we were working really hard to make sure he didn't get angry. And he didn't get angry in my house. He didn't. He really didn't. But how was it that I was then working so hard to make sure that he didn't get angry? Something was going on. Like, I don't know, right? My mom was anxious about certain things. And I know that I worked pretty hard to make sure that she didn't ever get anxious. So you're working really hard to make sure that one parent doesn't get pissed off at you, and you're working really hard to make sure that another person doesn't get anxious. These kinds of practices make for a pretty good psychiatrist. Because as it turns out, you're practicing Long before you ever learned that you were beginning to practice this, you're practicing paying lots of attention to what's happening in the room. And you sense it and you know it before it even comes over the horizon. I'm 54, and only in the last 6 months have the implications of this story begun to do their work. And I feel like in the last 3 months, Jesus has come with his crowbar into my right hemisphere and opened up things that I didn't know I didn't know. With the help of people who really care about me, but also opening up things that I feel and sense that has been really, really disruptive. Here's something that's important to know. Healing is always disrupting. It's always disruptive. It always has side effects, some of which you will wish you don't have to experience. There is no other way. For our stories to be told effectively and fully will require the unearthing of parts of them that include things that don't have to do with language that we have been practicing, but because we're not paying attention to it with that part of our brain, we don't even know we've been doing this. Evil counts on this. Evil counts on our not paying attention to what we're paying attention to. Evil doesn't want me having a conversation with a group of therapists in which they start to turn the tables on their boss. What part of our stories that are being told without language are creating challenges for us? Another feature of stories is that they're told largely to be heard, right? We don't tell stories just to speak. If you wanted to do that, you could just talk to yourself in the mirror in the morning. Many of you, I'm sure, already do. But we long to tell our stories in order for them to be heard by the one who's receiving them. We are looking for someone looking for us. In the telling of our story, we are doing the same thing. We are looking for you to find me. I want to see myself in your eyes. My story, as it turns out, in the end, is not going to make sense until I see me in your eyes. That's the only way that my story ever will make sense. They are told to be heard. We're not just telling them collaboratively. We are telling them to be heard. And part of what I'm discovering at 54 is that there are large parts of my story that just haven't been heard because I didn't know that they were there to tell. That makes sense? When I was 13, I'm growing up in this family in which, I also had some other experiences. Right? So I was a classically trained pianist, and I started at the piano about age 8, and actually enjoyed playing the piano. But it's also one of those other things where, I grew up in a basketball playing family. So these three older brothers, all of them, played basketball in college. I tell people by the time it got to me, the talent pool had been thoroughly drained. I played in high school, but I didn't play in college. And we had one brother that played Division I at Florida. These guys were pretty good players. And in fact, my first word was ball. My first sentence was shoot the ball. I don't remember these things. These things are told to me. Maybe it's not even true. Who knows? But outside of our house driveway, there was a basketball court. And every day, elementary school through junior middle school, every day we'd come home, and in the spring and in the fall, summer, what's happening after school? Kids are coming to my house to play basketball. My friends. And where am I? I'm practicing the piano. Now, it was an unspoken rule that, you know, you work first and play later. Anybody grew up with that rule? Yeah, great. I get it in theory, except if you're me, right? As a kid who wants to be able to play basketball and like, but there's no thinking of like having a conversation with my mom in which I say, hey, let's see. There's X number of hours between now and when I go to bed. In only one of those hours are my friends going to be here to play basketball. I could practice the piano later, play basketball now, or play the piano now or play basketball. The problem is that when I'm done with my piano, my friends are gone. Let's do the math here, Mom. No, this is not a conversation that we would have. So I would dutifully play the piano, and day after day after day, my friends would be gone. And so I'd go outside, I'd shoot around, but you know how this goes. Again, it's a first world problem, right? They would say, well, it's a first world problem. And this, of course, is another part of how shame works. Shame wants us to know it's a first world problem, right? It's a first world story. It's not that much, like, so quit your complaining about this. You with me? The point is that there was a certain way in which I began to tell my story. And by the time I was 14, I quit playing the piano. And I'm sorry that I did. But in no small part because there were large swaths of that experience in which it wasn't really inquired of me what I wanted to play, what I thought about, all these kinds of, you get the picture. Again, we're like my parents, wonderful people. No question, wonderful people. You would love them if they were here. You would love them and they would love you. And they would love me. And they would be okay with us even telling these stories because they're that kind of people. But in the moment, you find that your story is being told collaboratively by other people with lots of it being told without using language, right? Because we learn not to say things. Shame counts on this. It counts on our not saying things, despite the fact that we desperately long for our stories to be heard. And the last thing that we talked about, one of the features of storytelling, is that they are also told by those who listen. Look, let's just be clear. If there were only like 10 of you in the room, this would be a very different kind of conversation, right? Your presence, your listening to what I'm saying is, as we do this, changing and altering what I'm saying. Cody, your being there changes the fact that I'm saying things the way that I say them. It's just the way that it works. We as listeners to people's story, as much as anything, help tell the story. Imagine this then. We've asked the question, who are the people who are in your life, who are the voices who are talking to you collaboratively, helping you tell the story? The other question is, whose story are you collaborating with? Who are you the listener? Whose story are you the listener of, such that you as well as they are helping them tell their story more effectively? Who needs to see that you are the light of the world? Matthew chapter 5. I find this interesting. You know, Matthew chapter 5, toward the end, Jesus says, you are the light of the world. Who lights a candle and then puts it under a bushel basket? Who does that? I read that text, you are the light of the world, and I immediately feel responsible. Right? I'm the light of the world. I want to say one of those words that Quakers aren't allowed to say. I'm a Quaker. I mean, I'm an evangelical Quaker, right? So I'm great, right? I'm the light of the world, super. Because I feel like I feel responsible. But what if that's not the way it's said or written? What if Jesus is saying, no, you don't get it. Because I'm sure I don't. When he says, no, it's important for you to know that your light is my delight. Like, that's how you are. You are light because I'm just so crazy about you.
And I want you to know that when you step off your porch today, that somebody is going to be lit up because of you. And I can't wait to see it happen. Not a light of responsibility, but a light of joy. In this sense, we as listeners are going to joyfully help others tell their story. Others who, when they come to you with their bad day, can't imagine a story of joy until they run into you, the light of the world. We have this we have this gratitude exercise that we give for patients. Anybody here shop at the same grocery store for the most part? No? All these new things I'm learning about Texans. I go all over Dallas shopping at different grocery stores every week. I put 500,000 miles on my car in 3 months. If you go to the same grocery store, do you go to the same grocery store enough to like be familiar with some of the folks that work there?
Yes.
Okay. Folks that like help you either at the checkout line or they bag your groceries, something like that?
Yes.
Try this. Now, of course, I know in Texas, everything's big, and so you might live 20 miles from your grocery store. I don't know where you live, but if it's not too inconvenient to do this, here's an experiment. The next opportunity you get your groceries on whatever day you get them, like on Saturday, we'll pretend. Get them on Saturday. If you're able, on Monday, go back to the grocery store, and you find the person who rang up your groceries. You find the person who bagged your groceries, and you say, I just want to tell you, you bagged my groceries for me 2 days ago, and I'm just really thankful for all the work you're doing. First of all, they're going to dial 911. That's the first thing they're going to do, because they're going to think that you've come out of the psych hospital, like without, you know, you're on visitation and somebody's not watching you. Because nobody does this. Nobody is so convinced that they are the light of the, in somebody else's world, that in coming back to express gratitude, you change their day life forever. And in so doing, as the listener, you tell the story. Does that make sense? That's just one example of dozens of things that we can do to pay attention to how we as listeners are telling each other's stories. When other people come to us and we start to ask the kinds of questions that God asks of Adam and Eve, where are you? That Jesus asks of John the Baptist's disciples, what are you looking for? Tell me about that. The features of stories. Two more things that we're going to talk about, these two other bullets before we wrap up. Now, kids, and remember, this whole storytelling venture, as we're going to see tomorrow, God's whole mission is to tell this story of joy and delight and have dominion, rule over the earth, love one another, create, love like, live like we live. That whole part of creativity begins with storytelling. Storytelling is primarily an adventure in creativity. We're making things up. We're creating things. Right? I had to live by creating a story, a narrative that essentially said, without words, that there are certain things in this house that are not okay for you to want or to ask for. We learned to live. Which, like, I have to stay away of my mom's depression. I have a friend who, when her mom would get depressed, her mom would walk into her bedroom, close the door, and would not come out for a week. And this kid would be like 8, 9 years of age. Can you imagine? How does that 8-year-old make sense of her life? Banging on the door, crying for a mother. We create things. We make things. We make things. We don't know how to not do that. We are making things up all the time.
It is the nature of creativity for us to make things, but also to make things collaboratively, right? Because even as we tell stories, like my story, so I'm married, right? And I have two kids. So my story that I tell doesn't just involve my story about me. It involves what I think you think about me, what I think my wife thinks about me, what I think my kids think about me. I'm telling a story, including the story I think you're telling about me. You see how this goes. It can create problems. It is the nature of creativity that this is how we operate as storytelling vessels. And then there's the creativity of relationships. And this is the part that, you know, we're going to start to move. We're going to kind of, this is where we start to turn toward this more direct question about shame. One wonders, right? God has done his thing in Genesis 1, and then he tells a story in Genesis 2. He makes us out of dirt and breath. He recognizes that it's not good for us to be alone. He makes one who complements the other. And he gets to the end of chapter 2. After all this joy and all this messiness of chapter 2, right, because it's not very linear, it's kind of all over the place, very organic, like a garden. And the text says very plainly, and the man and the woman were naked and unashamed. Right? And I'm wondering to myself, why naked and why unashamed? Like, why is the writer emphasizing these words? I want to invite us to consider that the word naked is really a way to describe the fact that we are vulnerable creatures. When we talk about vulnerability, we sometimes like to talk about it as if something it's something that we choose to do. I don't really want to be that vulnerable. I'm not going to be that vulnerable. And I get it. Here's the thing. We are vulnerable. It's why everybody here is wearing clothes. It's true. We're wearing clothes because we're vulnerable. Like, if you're, like, what dog wants to be in clothes? Now, some people put their dogs in clothes. That's troubling. Dogs can go pretty much anywhere they want to go, and they don't ask for a Brooks Brothers. They don't ask for this. They're fine to, like, just go out kind of like as they are. I'm just being a dog. And they're not worried. Like, they're naked, and they're not ashamed. Right? We can't do that. We are vulnerable creatures by nature. We need clothing. And we also need the protection of other humans. The brain does not do well when it's by itself. My vulnerability is also something that speaks to the fact that I am a single being who only flourishes in the context of connection with other single, vulnerable beings. But Genesis 2:25 says that we're not just naked. It says that the first couple were made and they were unashamed. Now, you know, you wonder about this. Like, the Hebrews had lots of words that they could have used. Why unashamed? Why not they were naked and they were unafraid? They were naked and they were happy. They were naked and they were joyful, right? We were made for joy. They were naked and confident. They were naked. Oh, there's lots of other words that we could use. Now, one might say, well, Kurt, you know, just read the text. I mean, they're getting you ready for what comes next in Genesis 3 because of all the really bad things that happened there. Yeah, true, but I just want to suggest this. I want to suggest that part of why this is the case, we'll learn this tomorrow when we talk about shame explicitly. There is nothing, there's no affect that is more primitive, more primal than shame in disrupting the creative process. There is nothing more disruptive than shame in disrupting the creative process for which you were intended to be on the earth. To be vulnerable and for shame not to be in the conversation puts you on the precipice of creativity, the vastness of which you are unable to imagine. And this is where the first couple stood. But it's important to know that where they stood was in a place in which they desperately, deeply needed each other. They weren't just without shame, they were also in deep need of each other. And one of the things that we know that shame does is that it creates storytelling vignettes in which I learn very quickly not to let myself need someone else, because the minute I need someone else and need to tell you what I want and what I desire, I lose the puppy. And I just don't want to have that repeated. In what story do you believe you're living?